Welcome to Chip Chat, an interview series that connects you with technology experts around the issues that industry is focused on today. And now your host, Allison Klein.
Welcome to Chip Chat. We're recording live from the Intel Developer Forum. It's day two at IDF in San Francisco. And today, I'm starting off our live cast with Pauline Nis, General Manager of Mission Critical Computing at Intel and a frequent guest on Chip Chat. Welcome, Pauline.
Hi, Allison. It's great to be here.
So we're at day two in IDF, and I've got some initial thoughts on what's going on in the data center from what I've seen so far, but what are your key takeaways thus far at the event?
Well, we've really not been announcing anything new this year, so we've been spending the time meeting with our partners and meeting with the analysts and just kind of getting a sense from them about the reception to the E7 launch earlier this year and what they're seeing from the customers. And it's always good to talk to people who talk to customers and can give you kind of a good sense of where their headset is at. And they've been really excited about the product. I think that Nehalem a year ago was our first foray into doing 4 and 8 socket and large Xeon systems. But with Wesmer coming along, the adoption is much faster. People have had a chance to evaluate the technology, and we're seeing really exciting wins out there and really exciting things happening with our partners.
You know, the last time you were on the program, you were talking about the Wesmer release, and then you were talking about some of the new types of applications coming into the world of mission critical computing, such as new capabilities in business analytics, larger transitions in terms of management of data. And I think you were prophetic, because the big takeaway for me so far at IDF is this blurring of the lines between cloud computing, mission critical computing, and even HPC as we approach data collection and analysis. So can you tell me a little bit about how all those things connect, and you know, where you see mission critical playing a role in all of this space?
Well, you're absolutely right. The lines are blurring, and we spend a lot of time looking at what we call usage cases, because we're trying to understand exactly what people want to do with the data, because that helps us then figure out where in that continuum it falls. And I'd start with probably a couple of really high-level things. The first one would be that in the mission-critical space, although it's not detached from analytics and it's not detached from big data, in my mind it helps to clarify it, because Mission Critical still does a lot of transactions and still moves a lot of money or critical data. And as I say to people, it's one thing to surf the web looking for something you want to buy. The minute you click buy, though, and you have to give them a credit card number, you want to be on an entirely different class of server, because suddenly now security is very, very important. This is going to debit your account. You know, I myself could tell you personally the number of credit cards I've had compromised buying from less than totally legitimate websites. Mm-hmm. And so now I'm much more sensitive about what I do. Now, that feeds the whole universe, though, because the analytics of what you bought go into the BI side. And that's where the world of kind of the web traffic and the cloud kind of overlap with mission critical, which is, you know, what is the data? How secure does the data have to be? Is it financial data? Is it regulated data? Is it corporate data? For instance, we're not going to put data about our fab lines out on, you know, the cloud.
Oh, sure we are. Why not?
No. I think, and even Jason Waxman would tell you, there's a way to go in terms of data security, data federation, all of the tools that you need. That being said, I'll spend a little bit of time later giving you some great examples of how mission-critical people are trying to adopt cloud practices. Then where the overlap between cloud and HPC comes in is analyzing all of this data. And it's one thing to analyze data out of a traditional database like Oracle or SQL Server and do BI analytics there, but now you have all this big data coming in from the web and all mm-hmm. of the social media data. And what excites me about it is it's really driving lots and lots of new startups who are trying to develop heuristics for how you analyze this data and how you make sense out of it, because it doesn't look like structured data at all. I spent last night talking to some guys at the blogger reception who are really doing almost, I wouldn't even call it algorithms, it's more like heuristics to find areas of real interaction, you know, in Twitter feeds. In other words, what are people talking about? Where do you get these dense spots where suddenly you're seeing a lot of tweets about a particular mm-hmm. subject? And what does that mean about what's going on out there and other stuff you should look at? And so social media brings a whole new set of analytic challenges. But what unites us all is it needs compute, it needs storage, it needs the ability to do a lot of it very, very quickly, because obviously, if you're trying to use social media as a way to influence your marketing, you need to move quickly when you see something happening. I mean, we're all talking this morning about Target and what happened yesterday mm-hmm. with a new line that came out and totally over. Their website was still down this morning mm-hmm. and the stores were sold out by 10 a.m. yesterday. So I think Target has probably learned something about web merchandising and capacity on demand today.
Well, I think that... You brought up a ton of different topics that I want to explore more, but before I forget, we are on live, so I've got to remind the audience, if you do have questions for Pauline, we'll get to them after our break, but please send them via the chat window on Blog Talk Radio or on Twitter at Intel Chip Chat. You brought up a lot of topics, but one thing that I wanted to get to, for those who are listening that may not have the knowledge of data structures and the difference in data and how it's handled within different data centers. When you look at something like social media data or web scale databases, what is the challenge in presenting that data and analyzing it from what you would look at as a traditional mission critical enterprise database?
What it's really all about, without trying to make it too complicated, is how the data is organized and how easy it is to search. And what people have done traditionally is that transactional databases, which know your credit card and all your information and, you know, link to your bank or what have you, have been very structured databases because the data is relational. In other words, once it gets your credit card, it wants your address. And once it gets your address, it wants the bank that issued the credit card. Mm-hmm. And it's all connected with a set of links. But you have the data set up that way so that it's easily linked to each other. When you want to do analysis, you're looking to organize the data entirely differently. You might not actually care until the end about the person's name. You might be looking for buying patterns and what's selling well and where traffic is increasing or where there's merchandise that's not selling. And in the past, because data has to be structured differently to do that, people would extract data from one of those organized relational databases and they would load it into an analytic database where it would be set up entirely differently so that you can do the kind of inquiries into it that have different relationships. And that all used to be very, very cumbersome. And lately, people have been playing around with a lot of techniques to make that back-end analytic portion faster, primarily because there's a lot more data. A lot of it is on the web, and it's unstructured to begin with, so you could never pull it out of a structured database. And that's probably spawned more innovation in the last 2 or 3 years because of the capacity we've delivered with these Xeon processors. Now, I was astonished because I came up here Monday, finally collapsed into bed and opened up the San Francisco Chronicle, not exactly a leading edge technical venue. And they had an article in there about how analytics wasn't just for big companies like Walmart anymore. And, you know, it was before IDF started, but it was this whole thing about the fact that now small to medium businesses want to tap in to the mobile phone data, the location data, the sales data, the things that can help them grow their business. And so that's what's been driving that innovation. And you've got certainly the traditional players doing some of it. SAP has been doing this project called HANA, which is an in-memory analytic database. And the whole goal of it is to keep everything, to put all of this data in memory, analyze it in memory, and have it be so fast that you could get 40 nanosecond response time from a query. Now, you might argue that you or I or any marketing person looking at data doesn't need 40 nanosecond response time. But if you're trying to instrument a production line and you're trying to drive equipment that's on that line and give it feedback, that's what's generating the need to do it, because analytics isn't just consumer retail, analytics is anything that helps me make my business more efficient, more effective. And I talked to a customer from a major oil company. They actually instrument with sensors now their wells in the ground, and real-time analytics are letting them leave the wells in the ground longer. And if you can leave a well in the ground for 2 more weeks pumping oil, you've paid for the cost of that analytics system. But you need to be monitoring what's going on at the base of the well, whether it's going to collapse, the motions of the drill bit, all of those kinds of things that they would guess at before, that they now can sensor, drive into an analytics system, or is it an HPC system, and get an answer back and really be driving the equipment. And then on the other end, you have all of the sexy stuff that's happening with how do you analyze Twitter feeds, how do you analyze web-based data, Hadoop and the sort of scale-out model, which is as long as it's unstructured, we can use a scale-out infrastructure that puts together, you know, hundreds or thousands of CPUs, takes advantage of all the cores to do much quicker analysis and get me data back while somebody is still in my store. I mean, the ultimate in retail is to flash on somebody's cell phone screen and offer to them while they are still in your store, because that means you have a much, much higher probability of getting them to buy. They haven't walked out. They haven't completed the transaction.
We should give that idea to Target.
Yes, we should.
So when you look at all of this, and you know, you've been in the mission critical computing space for a long time, is there a right path in terms of the approaches, or does it make sense to have multiple avenues for analytics moving forward, depending on where the data is coming from?
Oh, you're absolutely going to see multiple avenues, because as much as Target wants to be web-based and is going to learn from this, Target's not going to walk away from stores. So how do you connect the stores and the people with their phone traffic that's in a physical store with the transactions, which is what you're actually buying and selling, because having you be in the store is only important if they can track what you spend in the store. And then to connect that to what you buy online. And more importantly, what you might buy other places and why you chose that versus Target. You know, they're really trying to connect to the customer. Their whole purpose of developing that one-on-one relationship with you is to get to know you better, to find out, okay, maybe you spent $50 at Target today, but did you spend $50 somewhere else? And why, and how can I move more of that into my establishment?
You know, it's interesting. The other insight that I had when you were talking was that data analytics, and maybe this is, you know, my egocentric model, but data analytics is not necessarily to make us smarter all the time, that it can be automated. And so even though my response time for, let's say, a Facebook query, it's nice to have my friends up, it doesn't really matter if I have to wait 2 more seconds. I can learn patience. But for that oil drill, you know, that type of data structure and also speed is very important, which takes me to the next question, which is when we look at these new large data sets and the challenges in analyzing them, what does that do in terms of how we look at server platforms and server architecture, and how will that influence our design moving forward?
Well, what I think it does is it marries very nicely with where Kirk's data center group has gone. We used to just be servers, and a couple of years ago we picked up storage and networking, and now the embedded group has joined. And I think that's all very important, because I think it's the continuum of what you're designing for. That handling all this data doesn't just mean that we have to have all these great Xeon parts that, you know, have got 10 cores or however many cores they've got, and you put them all together, you get 8-core systems. You have to have the storage that's feeding them and the network that's connecting the users to them. And have the data keep flowing, because the question is always, where's the bottleneck in the system? If you've made the processors faster but the data's not getting there, that's why SSDs have been so exciting, because they're a way to move that data in faster. It's why switching has been so important, why 10 gig E and 40 gig Ethernet is going to be important. And even where embedded comes in, because what has always challenged us a little bit is the embedded group owns our relationship with all the telecoms.
Right.
And they do a lot of embedded work with them into products that they do. But they are gatekeepers for traffic moving in and out of the phones and the network. And so, you know, that looking at that whole continuum is what we have to do to solve these problems in the future.
Okay, we'll keep talking about this data challenge moving forward after the break, and I've got some other questions for you about virtualization.
Okay.
We'll be right back with more of Allison's interview. Have a question? Visit us at twitter.com/IntelChipChat. We'll be answering questions live next.
And we're back live from the Intel Developer Forum. This is Chip Chat, and I'm talking to Pauline Niss, General Manager of Mission Critical Computing at Intel. Pauline, we just spent 15 minutes going through a very rapid discussion of big data, database architectures, structured versus unstructured data, and the collide of cloud, HPC, and mission critical computing. And I'm going to switch focuses for you to another topic that's related, which is the role of virtualization in mission critical. I was at VMworld. Was it last week? I can't remember. Last week or the week before?
Week before, because I was in Japan. I had to miss it.
And they started talking about some mission-critical features that are showing up in their software. Can you tell us what they announced?
Yes, we're very proud of the work we've done with VMware, because while virtualization has been very pervasive, it has really been smaller VMs and stateless kinds of applications, you know, in the web space and the web hosting space. And we really are just starting to see people, relatively recently look at putting things like ERP or CRM or things into virtualization configurations. We worked with Red Hat on a couple of things, Red Hat and VMware on a couple of things, and we've still got a ways to go. But VMware made some major announcements. The first one was that we implemented with Nehalem a machine check recovery architecture that would let the CPU recover from certain errors. And we got most of the operating system vendors to implement that shortly within the year after Nehalem. But now with Westmere and the fact that we're continuing down this and we're going to be adding more and more recovery features as we go forward, we really wanted the virtualization layer to pull that up so that they could have that kind of recovery and not crash, because that's very important for mission critical. So VMware has turned on our machine check architecture recovery in VMware. And then the other really big announcement they made a week and a half ago was that they're now supporting what they call monster VMs, which is up to a 32-socket VM that can address up to a terabyte of memory, which is really important if you want to virtualize one of these bigger database applications, because, you know, with service level agreements and everything, it wants to consume a pretty big chunk of the system. And then more importantly was Palmer Ritz's new passion for high availability and disaster recovery, because while virtualization has driven up utilization and made people more efficient and given them a very quick reaction times, it is a really great tool to potentially use for fault tolerance, so that you could do something that accomplished what partitions do in Unix and allow you to set up sections of the machine and move jobs between them or even between machines faster. And we're happy to see that the VMware is really starting to see a lot of demand from customers for this and pay attention to it. Because we talked to them about it a few years back, and they were just really in the middle of, you know, kind of really explosion in deployments and kind of focused on efficiency and management and everything else. And I think this is kind of the next step in the maturity of virtualization and really putting it into the mission critical world.
So you talked about machine check architecture. You know, we throw that term out so easily at Intel like it's water, but it's somewhat fundamentally important to our enterprise customers. So I think it's worth a little bit of time. Machine check architecture, what does it do for the system, and what assurance does it give the customer?
Well, what every customer is always afraid of is a machine that's going to go down. In the web-based applications, like the web hosting space, it's pretty easy to vector somebody over to another processor. But if you're in the middle of one of these database transactions, it becomes much more important. You need to know whether the transaction completed or not. You need to get, you know, the data connected to another system. You need to pick up where you left off. I'm sure you've been in situations where you've tried to check out and you've had the checkout process go bonkers and it either not let you check it out or tell you to come back later. And what it means is that it's really having problems. What the machine check architecture is another round of implementations at the chip level that attempts to let the chip recover from certain classes of errors. Mm-hmm. And this is a journey because there are many, many error types, and we have started down that path. We implemented error recovery for a whole class of memory errors with Nehalem and Westmere, and we'll add yet another bigger set of errors when we go to the Ivy Bridge generation. So we're going to be ever increasing that, but the goal is to say if the CPU can collect enough information to keep running, can you retry things and recover from them and not have the system go down? And particularly as you end up with, you know, 80 core systems, you don't want to take 80 cores with however many, you know, hundreds of mm-hmm. VMs you have on it down because you had a problem with one CPU or in one area. And that's the big challenge. How do you continue to grow it and enlarge it so you compartmentalize and then attempt to recover as much as you can?
And then when you take this to the virtualization layer, does this then extend to being able to isolate faults to a particular VM, or what is the added benefit?
It gives the VM a chance to access the same recovery tools that the operating system is doing and try to recover. But that's why what Moritz is talking about for high availability is so exciting, because VMs have a lot more flexibility. When you're running on a physical machine, we can give you tools that say maybe you can recover from this end, but some of them you can't recover from. If you had high availability implemented with a VM, first the VM would try and recover. Then if it couldn't, it would say move the VM to another part of the machine that's still running, or to another machine that's still running. And that's why working with the virtualization providers is so important to pull through this capability.
And that really brings us to our next topic, is that we really have been embedding many more mission critical features on our Xeon platforms, and continuing to win more customers in terms of moving them off of RISC platforms onto industry standard Intel architecture platforms. I always ask you this question: what new customers do we have that have migrated, and are there any interesting stories there?
Well, my first one, and this is one of the things that drives me crazy, was I was jumping up and down at about midnight last night because I got an email from our financial team that in a major U.S. financial institution, major, we have just had a RISC conversion win where we're going to get across 2 years, I think, 1,700 CPUs converted from RISC to Xeon. Certainly, it didn't happen overnight. We've had a very lengthy multi-year relationship, and we went in and did some proof of concepts, and we did some performance benchmarking against a couple of the key RISC players because they were looking for a next-generation purchase, and the question was to stay with RISC or to move to Xeon. And they're not going to, unfortunately, let us do any public marketing, but what we are going to do is a whole section of BKM stuff for the rest of our field guys to say, here's exactly what we went through with this customer, here's the proof points we did, here's the benchmarking we did. We used the North American RISC Without Rewards Risk with Rewards program, mm-hmm. And we think we can use it as a little bit of a template to energize some of the other sales guys that you can go in and you can win these big conversions. We've got the performance, we've got the features, we've got the functionality that it takes to go in and deliver this, and we can do the kind of proof points that people want to see it. One of the other great ones I learned about this year is there's a major healthcare ISV, and this one will work, I think, to probably get a public story. And they had the traditional route to market, which is they have a whole package for managing everything in a hospital, from patient order entry to diagnostics, images, pharmacy, the whole nine yards. And what they used to do was partner with the OEMs and sell a big RISC system. Mm-hmm. So they'd sell a system with their software installed. They wanted to grow, and they wanted to get to small to medium hospitals and help get these electronic medical records turned on. What they did was they set up their own software as a service offering. Now, I wouldn't call it a cloud, but it's a perfect example of how mission critical learns from the cloud. They're currently running 22,000 Blade servers from one of our major OEMs,
wow.
Servicing hundreds of local hospitals, 24/7, multiple systems configured redundantly with failover. But what they learned from the cloud was standardize on one configuration, use it for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
They can turn on new customers very, very quickly because it's always the same configuration. Their ops people are much better trained. They get better coverage because it's 22,000 Blade servers. They all look the same. You open the rack, it's the same networking configuration, the same storage configuration, the same CPU and memory configuration, and it's enabled them to grow by leaps and bounds. They're the fastest growing segment of the company. And though while it's not, quote, a cloud, they've learned about standard configurations, about agility, about turning things on, and now they're just starting to play with what are the right areas to virtualize and get that next level of efficiency.
And my final question for you, which is not surprising, this came in from the audience, you know, and Kirk talked about it in his press briefing yesterday. You've talked about Xeon. How about Itanium? You know, what is Intel's view on Itanium, and how does that fit in mission critical strategy?
Well, contrary to what maybe some people up the peninsula may have told you, we are 200% committed to Itanium. In fact, just a few weeks ago, we did another release of the next level of detailed information about the next generation Poulsen chip. It was at the Hot Chips Conference, and I did a blog about that, so people can go to the server room and they can read. We talked about new instructions that are being added, about multi-threading, parallelization. We continue to be on target for more or less a mid 2012 launch with our partners. We'll have the chips there in time. We're feeling very good about the performance of the parts and the features that we've added, and a lot of testing is going on right now, and we've already kicked off the initial architectural development and planning for Kitson, which will be the chip that follows Poulsen. This is about when you would expect to see that, because Poulsen people kind of roll off and go work on the next one. So as Poulsen is really using all of the verification, the testing people, the architects and the designers can start worrying about the next generation. So we're very committed to it, very committed to working with HP and our other major OEMs like Boole and NEC, who are doing chips with Itanium. We've also, at IDF in Beijing in February, announced two new major Chinese OEMs who are building Itanium systems. And one of them, I believe, had a press conference yesterday. Inspur announced not only its 8-socket systems, but that it was going to have 32-socket Itanium systems by year end. And Huawei is the other Chinese OEM that's doing Itaniums. And Huawei is not a small name. I would hope that a lot of people in the telephone business recognize them.
Yeah, the Chinese announcements earlier this year really underscore some of the changes in terms of mission-critical computing that is going on in that country.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you so much, Pauline. It's always a pleasure. Not a surprise on your answers, and that inspired some new thinking for me. So we'll have you back on the program again soon. If you didn't get a chance to ask a question or have some follow-up, where can people find you online?
Well, they can always tweet me. I'm at PANIST on Twitter, and I'm in the server room and answer questions that people post for my blogs. I'm always at Intel.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.